In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal, with a focus on some third-party and independent candidates for president this election cycle. First, environmental activist and physician Jill Stein, running again on the Green Party ticket. Then, Angela McArdle, chair of the National Libertarian Party, on that party's history and policy platform, and the upcoming presidential nominating convention. Plus, independent candidate and progressive activist Cornel West.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach, so no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
We begin with 2016 and now 2024 Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein.
So tell us about why you're seeking this third-party bid and what differentiates you from the other candidates.
Well, Americans are really hurting, and they're really hurting for something different. People are really tired of being thrown under the bus by wealthy elites and their bought politicians. People are living paycheck to paycheck. 63% of workers, actually, half of people who rent, are financially stressed, just trying to keep a roof over their heads. You have 100 million people in medical debt, 44 million struggling in student debt. So people are really hungry for a change. And what makes me different as a Green Party candidate is that we are not bought and paid for. We actually don't accept corporate PAC money. We don't sanction super PACs, which is how billionaires can pour unlimited amounts of money into the routine political parties and the routine campaigns, that is, from the establishment parties, and basically, you know, call the shots from the inside, because it's the billionaires and the bankers who are basically funding those campaigns and those political parties. So I have the unique ability to meet people's really urgent needs with solutions that are proven, that work, that stop the incredible waste, fraud, and abuse that's built into the system.
So how are you funding your campaign and your party in general?
Small donors, just everyday people. You know, the big parties, that is Democrats and Republicans, they, you know, they function with super PACs. Super PACs don't contribute actually to the campaigns, but they work to support the campaigns. We disavow any such things. The Democrats and Republicans, they have all these loopholes, like, for example, what are called victory funds, whereby a single donor with very deep pockets can write one check for $600,000 or more and exert huge influence in the party and in the campaigns. You know, we have what's called the best democracy that money can buy, and that's no democracy at all. We should be about everyday people, not the billionaires, the bankers, the fossil fuel barons, the insurance companies, big pharma, you know, the ones who are calling the shots and really driving the American people over the cliff.
And can you tell us about how much you've raised for this campaign cycle?
Let's see. So far, since the beginning of the cycle, and we started around November, It's somewhere around, I want to say 200, 300,000, something like that, maybe a little bit more. You know, so we are raising money from small donors, but we are a volunteer and small donor powered party. So, for example, for us to get on the ballot, because we're a grassroots network, we have state parties all over the country who participate in our democracy. We have ballot access already. We have about 75% of that work done. It will cost us about $1 or 2 million to get on the ballot. For a candidate like Robert F. Kennedy, who is not a grassroots campaign and is not, shall we say, of, by, and for the people, who has a big super PAC funded by billionaires, for him to get on the ballot, it will cost him at least $15 to $18 million. So we do things in a grassroots, people-powered way, which is much more cost-effective and efficient.
Well, you mentioned RFK Jr., I'll show this headline from The Washington Post, which says, RFK Jr. campaign turns down debate request from Jill Stein. Can you tell me about why you want to debate him, on what, and why you think he turned you down?
Well, you know, I think the American people want to know who their candidates are and what are their policies. And, you know, unfortunately, it's par for the course for candidates to mislead the public and mislead their supporters. So RFK, for example, claims to be a peace candidate, yet he is one of the most aggressive candidates in supporting the genocide in Gaza and supporting the Israeli massacre going on now in Palestine, which is actually horrific and which the majority of American people want to see an immediate ceasefire for and a negotiated solution. He's all for, you know, weaponizing and militarizing and giving unlimited weapons and military support for Israel to continue conducting this war. So we think it's really important for the public to be able to hold people accountable. You know, it is the job of the press, and to the credit of C-SPAN, that you allow all voices to be heard. You allow the public to actually ask questions and demand transparency and accountability. That's what democracy is about. We badly need debates, but you see the major parties basically abandoning those debates. Neither Donald Trump nor Joe Biden will participate in debates now. And RFK is following in that tradition here by refusing to clarify his war policy. If, you know, he says, well, I'll debate the big candidates, you know, the guys that are equivalent to me. He wants to be in the category with Trump and Biden. But unfortunately, they agree on way too much, especially about war. And the Middle East is not like some negligible little piece of the pie here. You know, we are spending huge amounts of money for this overall endless war machine. The Middle East has been, you know, exhibit A for endless war and the consumption of our tax dollars and the creation of havoc, particularly in the Middle East. And it is an explosive situation. It badly needs to be debated in front of the American people, who aren't so happy about this. So, you know, this cannot be, you know, said to be, oh, I'm a peace candidate, but I support one of the most disastrous wars in our history, which is taking a big leap forward right now in a very dangerous way. And why did he refuse? You know, he doesn't want to be held accountable. He's not participating in debates. There is an alternative debate format now called Free and Equal, which is bringing many candidates across many different parties and holding debates between libertarians and greens and socialists. These are the ones that are participating. And that's a really interesting, novel conversation that we don't usually get to hear. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., unfortunately, has refused to participate in any of those debates. It's as if he doesn't want to be challenged. But it's really important. That's what democracy is about.
Well, can you give us an idea, Dr. Stein, of the major tenets of the Green Party? I think, you know, of course, there's the Green New Deal, if you can talk a little bit about that, and where you stand on the big issues of the day.
Sure. So let me mention off the bat here healthcare, because this is a crisis across the board. And there is a solution which is also supported across the board. And that's for us to expand a Medicare type system, which is the most efficient way of ensuring healthcare. It allows you to choose your doctor. It provides open networks. It's not forever, limiting your choices. But there are holes in Medicare and it needs to be improved. So we're supporting a Medicare for All plan, which actually the majority of American people support that type of plan. And this is across the political spectrum. And this would not cost us money. First, let me say it covers you from head to toe, from cradle to grave, your eyeglasses, your hearing aids, your mental health care, chronic care, home care, all the things that are excluded right now that you urgently need. And it actually saves us money. It doesn't cost us. It saves us $500 billion a year because our current private insurance system is so wasteful. There's so much bureaucracy and red tape that one out of every three healthcare dollars right now is being spent. It is basically being wasted and not spent on healthcare. So what Medicare for All does is drastically reduce this wasteful overhead and delivers the healthcare that people need. So that's an example of one of our policies, which is most popular, is a winning majority in poll after poll. That's something that the American people deserve. Why don't we have it right now? It's mainly because we have a very corrupted political system that's in the business of serving insurance companies and the big pharmaceutical companies. It would also provide your medications for free. This would be paid for, in the tax base, which would be a progressive tax base. So if you're rolling in dough, you pay a whole lot more. And if you're middle income or lower, the tax, your total cost actually goes way down if you consider the tax base that you would be paying for the new system versus what you're paying right now through your premiums, through your copays, through just all sorts of ways that you get bled to pay for healthcare.
Dr. Stein, you did mention student debt and medical debt and abolishing those two. How would you pay for that?
Well, first, let's start with student debt. And let me just preface this by saying, when we want to spend $100 billion on another war, nobody blinks an eye. There's no question. We now have a military budget, which is mostly getting us in trouble, fighting catastrophic war after war, which we lose and which is costing us, well over $1 trillion a year, over $21 trillion since the 9/11 wars began. Costs the average household right now $12,000 this year alone for the costs of our bloated and endangering military budget that impoverishes us at home and gets us into danger abroad. So we would enact, efficiencies here by cutting that very wasteful and dangerous military budget, by taking the waste out of healthcare and saving $500 billion a year, and other efficiencies and improvements that would basically enrich our budget in a very big way so that we can do the things that actually help the American people, that create true security, instead of squandering half of our congressional budget every year is spent on this endless war machine. So the whole question about where does the money come from, it would come from the same place the money always comes from. The difference is that it would be used on behalf of everyday people here. And we know that for every dollar that we spend on higher education, we know this from the GI Bill after the Second World War, every dollar that we put into higher education comes back to us in the form of economic benefits to the economy seven times greater. So this is a very efficient use of our tax dollars. And the student debt is almost entirely money that the government only owes to itself. So it's not like there's some payer and we'd have to come up with those dollars and pay them. This would be like an investment in our future. This would be a, an economic boost of our dreams that would enable young people to actually get out and start participating in the economy, to use the skills that they were told to develop that they need in order to have a secure financial future. So there are so many benefits and paybacks in the system. It pays for itself.
And Dr. Stein, as with any third-party candidate, I have to ask you about your role as possible spoiler. In 2016, accusations were leveled against you that you drew votes away from Hillary Clinton in key swing states, costing her the election. You got about 1.4 million votes total. How do you respond to the possibility of being a spoiler in this election?
This is the propaganda of a ruling power elite that's very nervous about losing their base. People who voted green and who traditionally vote green, but in my race in 2016, were people who otherwise were not going to come out and vote. We know that from poll after poll. We know that from talking to people. So this is just a false proposition. It's also extremely undemocratic to say that a certain party like Democrats own your vote, that Democratic candidates are entitled to your vote. No, that's the abuse that's built into the system. Democrats have not been serving their base, that is working people, for quite some time, which is why so many have moved over from voting Democratic to voting for Trump, not because they love Trump for the most part, but rather because they're really angry at the Democrats. And the proof of this is the election that was the most so-called spoiled for Democrats ever. And that was in 2010, when the Democrats lost 1,000 seats in their state legislatures. They lost 64 seats in Congress. They lost 13 seats in the Senate and about 13 or 14 governorships. So they were really whacked. There was no third party there that they could blame it on. This was because the Democrats holding the White House and both houses of Congress had just bailed out Wall Street to the tune of trillions of dollars. They bailed out the crooks who crashed the economy, and they threw out millions upon millions of homeowners. So people were very angry and were punishing the Democrats. And that is the underlying dynamic here. It's not because Greens are stealing votes. No, there's a huge bucket of people who will not otherwise vote. It was 100 million in the 2016 race. There are oodles of people who aren't voting because they don't like these choices being rammed down our throats. And that's especially true in this election. If you look at, for example, the primary in Michigan that was recently held, you not only had a substantial number, which was like 14% of people who were, you know, abandoned Biden, basically saying, we're not going to support Biden, we protest. But beyond those numbers, half of the voters, half the Democrats, or half the people, shall we say, who came out and voted Democrat in 2020, did not come out for the recent 2024 primary in Michigan. Why is that? You know, that's no secret. People are very fighting angry right now at these two choices being rammed down our throats, who do not have a track record for supporting everyday people.
That was Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. Next, Angela McArdle, chair of the National Libertarian Party, which is holding its presidential nominating convention next month.
All right, so start by telling us about the Libertarian Party and what you stand for.
Absolutely. The Libertarian Party is the third largest party in the United States. We stand for your personal and economic liberty. We all love peaceful foreign policy. We want you to keep your money. We don't like taxes. And we really want government to stay out of your personal life. We believe that individuals are the best people to govern their own lives.
And how many members are there? And how does one join the Libertarian Party?
Nationally, I believe we have roughly 14,000 current dues-paying members, but we've got many more thousands of members who've joined in the past, who contribute nominally and who are active and participating in our political party across the country. You can join at lp.org. It's a $25 a year annual membership. And what I think is really interesting about the Libertarian Party is that we have a non-aggression pledge, which means when you join the party, you agree to not pursue political violence.
And the history of the Libertarian Party, Angela, when was it established and why?
The Libertarian Party was established in 1971, really as a reaction to the United States going off of the gold standard. You had an interesting mix of individuals, some sort of politically left-leaning hippie types who got together with some libertarians who were more culturally on the right, who were outraged at Richard Nixon's policies and just very politically dissatisfied. And they came together to agree, you know, that there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a way forward with sound monetary policy, with peaceful foreign policy, you know, no wars overseas, and say no to the Vietnam War, and all of that good stuff. And they got together and formed in Colorado in 1971, and we started to see state parties pop up all over the country right after that.
You mentioned, Angela, that there's a pledge against political violence. I wanted to ask you if the Libertarian Party has an official position on the 2020 election and the events around January 6th.
We don't have an official position around that. Certainly, we don't support violent action, and to the extent that there was any violence that took place at the Capitol, we're not in support of that. But we do believe in people's right to peacefully assemble and to protest.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of policy issues and where you stand on it. So you have your platform is online. It's about 10 pages long for anybody that wants to read it. Can you tell us like where you stand on something like abortion?
The Libertarian Party does not take a stance on abortion. In 2022, at our national convention, we removed abortion from our platform. A majority of the members believe that it was too divisive of an issue and that it's something that we shouldn't take a formal position on. Our candidates and members are free to take their own positions on that topic, though.
And the topic of taxes. So I understand that the goal is to eventually phase out all taxes. Can you tell us how that would work as far as the services that we expect from the government, such as, you know, free K-12 education, the military? How does that work in funding the government?
Sure. So our party is split between people who would like minimal government, who we call minarchists, and anarchists, people who want zero government. And we definitely want to get rid of taxes, although there are still some members who are comfortable with a very small amount of tax revenue to support things like military and other services that they deem essential that should be provided by government. But generally, we want things to be privatized and we want things to be voluntary. There are a lot of private schools all across the world, including in places like India, where people pay very little to fund their children's education, and they do much better than they do in public government schools. You know, for example, government public schools are one of the most violent places a child can ever, you know, encounter. They're one of the most violent places a child will ever attend. It's places where they encounter bullying, they encounter really difficult situations. You know, school shootings, definitely something that we don't like seeing in the news. And so we encourage people to take their children's education into their own hands. Homeschooling, obviously, is in my opinion, the best way.
And as far as foreign policy, where you stand on support for the war in Ukraine and the Israel-Gaza war?
We don't support any of it. And we believe that the United States should end all foreign aid to Israel and all other foreign countries. We do not want to see troops put through the meat grinder of war in Ukraine. We don't want our money going to fund overseas conflicts. We do not believe that the United States should be meddling in other countries' foreign policies.
You've got 14 possible candidates. Can you tell us about the process of selecting the nominee that will be on the ballot?
Absolutely. So the majority of our candidates have been attending state conventions and getting to know our delegates and members for several months now. Some of them started campaigning a year ago. You've got to earn your nomination through delegate votes at a national convention. So the candidates like to get to know people, try to get votes pledged well in advance so that when they show up, everybody's already, you know, counted heads and understands what's going to happen. You've got to become a delegate at your state convention in order to go and participate at the national convention and have a say in who our next presidential candidate will be.
And I don't need to tell you that it's a little bit difficult for third-party candidates in this country. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on what you're really trying to accomplish by running a candidate?
Sure. So there are different ideas within the party about what we're trying to accomplish. Some of our members really do want to win the presidency. My perspective and the perspective of many of our other Libertarian National Committee members is that the presidential race exists as a platform for our message. We want to get the word out there about libertarianism, about the party, grow the party at the local grassroots level, get people elected locally, help down-ticket candidates, because ballot access is essential as well, and use the Libertarian presidential race as a platform to accomplish all those things. And certainly we want to be excellent messengers for the message of liberty and wake people up to the evils of large federal government.
And you mentioned getting on the ballot. You're on 37 now. Do you expect to get on all 50 states?
I believe we're going to get on 48 to 50 states. Illinois and New York are tricky, but we are actively working out plans right now to make it happen. New York requires 45,000 signatures in 6 weeks. You know, unfortunately, the state of New York kicked us off the ballot after Larry Sharp, a past gubernatorial candidate, got us ballot access. So it is definitely a challenge. It's a very expensive endeavor. It takes a lot of logistical networking, and it all has to happen very quickly. Illinois also requires 35,000 signatures, although thankfully it's not in a shorter period of time. But other than those two, I think we feel pretty comfortable where we're at in our ballot access race right now.
And the finally, before we get to calls, I just want to ask you about your nominating convention. It's happening end of May here in D.C. The theme is becoming ungovernable. What does that mean?
We want people to take their lives into their own hands. We do not like what we've seen come out of Washington, D.C., especially over the last administration. You know, President Biden has made such disparaging comments about American citizens, telling us that if we didn't abide by his medical edicts, that we would experience a severe winter of illness and death 1 year. He's had such divisive language. It just seems like the federal government wants more and more control over our personal lives. We're really interested in just taking that power back for ourselves. And so we encourage people to become ungovernable.
That was Angela McArdle, chair of the National Libertarian Party. Finally, a conversation with Dr. Cornel West, progressive activist and independent candidate for president.
Dr. Cornel West is a philosophy and Christian practice professor at Union Theological Seminary, also an independent presidential candidate, talking about his candidacy on Washington Journal this morning. Dr. West, good morning.
It's a blessing to be here. You're very kind to have me, my brother. I hope you and your loved ones are doing well.
Thank you very much for that. Dr. West, if you had to boil down your candidacy into a few sentences, what would you tell people?
It would be, it's based on the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and Fannie Lou Hamer, which is trying to get beyond the lies, beyond all the hatred, beyond all the revenge, and try to talk about truth, justice, and love in a context in which it seems as if it's very, very difficult to have any moments of substantive morality. Politics has become just legalized corruption and normalized a bribery where people will say anything to stay in office. And there's no genuine concern for people, let alone poor people, working people, people who have been subjugated, people who've been degraded. And this is not just empty moral rhetoric. If we give up on serious commitment to public life and citizens being human beings, as opposed to just objects to be manipulated and elites to reproduce more lies, more hatred, more revenge, then the country's over. I mean, the American project, as we've understood it, it would be over. And I'm just trying to do the best that I can to raise my voice, to mobilize people, and to get people to see that Trump's leading us toward a second civil war and Biden's leading us toward a third world war. And we've got to do better than those two in terms of an option at this particular moment in the history of this country.
If you were president, then what would a Cornel West administration do to change the plight of poor people specifically than others have promised or, and I guess in your opinion, haven't delivered yet?
Well, I mean, Biden has just authorized $200 billion for B-21 bombers. We could abolish poverty with a little over $200 billion. I'm an abolitionist when it comes to poverty, just like Martin King. I'm an abolitionist when it comes to homelessness. I just spent wonderful time with my brothers and sisters there on the East Side Cafe here in Los Angeles at El Sereno Community Garden. No housing. I was just a Skid Row with Master Q in Los Angeles. Skid Row has thousands and thousands of people. How can we be the richest nation in the history of the world and have so many poor people and homeless people? Well, we got organized greed. in the real estate industry. You got organized greed when it comes to housing, organized greed when it comes to healthcare, more and more organized greed when it comes to education. This is what happens when you have organized greed unleashed on a society with little accountability, and the most vulnerable are those who are most affected. It's got to be a moral compass when you talk about leadership in the country. And you know that that's so true in regard to the genocide and the ethnic cleansing and the ugly apartheid-like conditions in Gaza. That's a fundamental moral litmus test. We sit there and watch it taking place and still enable more billions of dollars to allow the military equipment that we produce from our tax money to go to killing and maiming children, 13,000 precious Palestinian children, and we act as if we can do nothing. I mean, this is spiritual sickness, my brother. It really is. And that's true for any people, no matter who it would be, black, white, red, Jewish, Lithuanian, or Ethiopian. But in this case, they're Palestinian. But it's in Gaza. I see it in L.A. I see it, of course, in New York. I see it in Chicago. And yet we want to congratulate ourselves as if somehow the economy is doing so well and we're bouncing back. No, we are in a spiritual, moral, and political crisis of profound proportions. And we need to get beyond the lies and the revenge and the hatred and talk about truth, justice, and love that begins with treating poor and working people.
Dr. West, forgive me if I'm wrong. Do you have any political background? And what do you think about electing someone to office without political background?
Well, I think what we need really, my dear brother, is we need new persons, new characters, and new visions injected into our system. So my political background is I've been fighting for poor and working people for 55 years. Now, I've worked with a number of different candidates over those 55 years. No doubt about that. Sometimes they're within the Democratic Party. Sometimes they've been outside. More and more they've been outside because the Democratic Party itself has succumbed to capture by Wall Street and Pentagon, by the war profiteers on the one hand and the money makers on the other. But the Republican Party had given up on a long time ago in terms of it being captured by big money. So it's true that people would look at me and say, well, you've never actually been an elected official. That's exactly right. I have been an active citizen trying to ensure that truth and justice can procure a place in American politics. And that's very much what I would do as president. I would set a completely different tone, a completely different vibe coming from the White House. And that would be, poor and working people, you are at the center of public policy, not Wall Street, not looking at the stock market, but rather Main Street and looking at access to healthcare, access to quality education, access to safe communities, access to housing. Housing is a human right, just like healthcare is a human right. And we've got to push back these predators who've been pushing out so many poor and working people when it comes to housing and a whole host of other
On your website, sir, one of the things that you advocate for is a wealth tax on all billionaire holdings and transactions, a $27 minimum wage, and establishing a federal universal basic income commission amongst them. But to the first part, as far as the wealth tax is concerned, I know that President Biden has called for increased taxes on the wealthy, but what's your definition of a wealth tax? How would that work in your mind?
Well, I mean, the wealth tax really is something that's very difficult to enforce. So as much as I would put it on paper very strongly and have high taxes for the wealthy, we know the wealthy are so clever with their brilliant lawyers and create loopholes. I'm much more concerned about disinvesting from the military. 62 cents for every $1 in the discretionary budget in Washington goes to the military. We've got 800 military units around the world, and we got special operations in 130 countries. We've got to cut back massively in military that goes directly into universal basic income. As you know, Alaska was the first state to endorse me, the Aurora Party, in part because we agree there ought to be a basic universal income, a social net below which citizens cannot fall, so that it's much more easier to disinvest from military and reinvest directly into satisfying basic social needs than to follow through on wealth tax, because we can have some of the most marvelous wealth tax on paper, and you can't execute it, my brother, because the loopholes are still there, and the lawyers are hired, and the tax evasion, you know, in Cayman Islands, you know the story, how difficult it is to follow through. So yes, I do support that on paper, but in terms of actually gaining resources for poor and working people, other than supporting that strong, strong minimum wage that you noted, and strong, strong wing of the trade union movement that's willing to fight for benefits and contribute to a robust public life in the country, that we've just got to engage in a disinvestment of significance from military into satisfying basic social needs of our citizens. I was in schools, I go to schools all the time, brother. I see more policemen in the elementary schools than I see nurses and counselors. Can you imagine if that was the case when you, well, I'm much, much older than you, but you and I going to school? Good God Almighty, these are precious students in the hoods, in the barrios, the reservation, poor whites. What kind of future are we talking about with that militarized context? I was just in Cop City in Atlanta. We see the militarization, not just of the police, but of any security officers. Why? Because as society begins to decay and decline, we appeal first resort to military. And we end up with more and more mass shootings, militaristic ways of dealing with conflict. That's a sign of a country that's going under. We've got to fight back. We've got to be countervailing forces against this kind of organized greed.
That was independent presidential candidate Dr. Cornel West. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.